From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the pros and cons of a massive project to rebuild and widen a stretch of I-75 in Oakland County.
You'll have an I-75 that is now built to handle 21st century traffic.
Unless there is really a demonstrated need for those extra miles of concrete to add extra capacity to the highways, it's just something that we don't think is a wise investment.
Going door to door to talk about race.
We start every conversation with the question, how do you feel in conversations when race comes up?
And police-related killings of unarmed black men inspire one painter to change his art.
I was just shocked and devastated, angry, and at a loss, and felt that I needed to change the direction my work was going in.
Those stories and more. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You're probably familiar with the term virtual reality. Gaming is an obvious VR application. But how much do you know about other uses of the technology? Coming up later in our Minding Michigan report, blending virtual reality with talk therapy to address anxiety and trauma. But first, this is the day MDOT kicks off its reconstruction and rebuilding of I-75. It will mean years, and I do mean years, of orange barrels for the up to 174,000 drivers who take I-75 between 8 Mile and M59. As road projects go, this one is a whopper. $1.3 billion, 18 miles of highway, and 14 years. MDOT's Rob Morosi is here with us now. I saw a quote from you, Rob, saying, no more Band-Aids, folks.
Yeah, that one got quite a bit of play, and it's true. You were taking a freeway that was primarily built in the 1960s, has never been rebuilt. It's had some resurfacings and some maintenance work put into it, but it has never been rebuilt. It just comes a time when a roadway needs to be replaced, and well, we've reached that time.
What are drivers on I-75 going to encounter on this day one?
The primary focus is southbound. Around M59, they'll encounter a left lane closure, and that is to get traffic into two lanes before it gets down by the Square Lake Road interchange. Now, the ramp from eastbound Square Lake to southbound 75, that's a two-lane ramp. We have that down to one lane. Primarily this year, the focus will be on the northbound rebuilding, and we're going to shift traffic in September from the northbound over to the southbound side, both directions sharing the southbound lanes, two lanes open in each direction. Stay that way till about mid-December, then for the winter months, everything will return to normal.
When all is said and done, let's look out 14 years, almost hard to believe, down the road, in 2030. What will I-75 have that it does not have now?
It will have an HOV lane in each direction that will be operated during peak travel times. Primarily, you will have a more modern I-75. You'll have an I-75 that is now built to handle 21st century traffic, to handle the vehicles made in the 21st century. When this freeway was built, again, we didn't have the type of average daily traffic numbers that we have now. Cars were different. They just weren't as fast, and they weren't as efficient as they are today. Now, that might seem odd to people, but when you're looking at the geometrics of a freeway, and I don't want to throw MDOT terms out there, but there's no real way to explain it. You know, when you're talking about hills, when you're talking about curves in the roadway, there has to be modern designs for vehicles traveling at 70 miles per hour.
Rob, there are critics who say that adding that fourth lane each way, adding more lanes, is going to actually lead to more traffic and more congestion and ultimately more sprawl. What do you say?
I don't know about that. I don't have that crystal ball, but this is what I do know, that this section of I-75 has one of the highest crash rates that we have in the metropolitan Detroit area. It has a higher crash rate than a four-lane I-696. It has a higher crash rate than a four-lane I-96. I don't have that crystal ball. I can't tell you that it will lead to more traffic and more congestion. But when you look at the accident figures, most of the accidents occur in dry conditions. Most of these accidents are rear-end collisions, which shows you this is not about slipping and sliding in ice or snow, and really constitutes a problem with congestion. Will it lead to more congestion? We'll just have to wait and see. Again, I'm not going to make a prediction on that. But I do know when we're talking about the safety aspects of a newer freeway, when we're talking about the safety aspects of replacing 47 bridges along the corridor, we need a 21st century transportation system in Southeast Michigan, one that provides options for users. And the final thing I'll say on this, 90% of what we're investing is replacing what exists today.
What of the critics who say, look, make some changes, make it safer, but why spend $1 billion and really pull out the stops, and why can't some of that money go to public transportation?
80% of the cost of this is covered by the Federal Highway Administration. We have a very important vote coming up in Southeast Michigan in November. We do support RTA. We do support options for all users, but we also have to keep in mind that what we're looking at here is a freeway that carries over $20 billion worth of commerce a year. I think we have over 20,000 businesses, over 330,000 employees 3 miles east and west of I-75. Options are incredibly important. Would some people prefer transit over driving a personal vehicle? I'm sure they would, and that's what this vote in November is about. But we can't take away the fact that 90% of the cost of this is replacing what exists today. So we need a 21st century transportation system, one that accommodates and provides options for all users.
Rob Morosi is with the Michigan Department of Transportation, kicking off day one of the big, big project for the next 14 years, reconstruction and rebuilding of I-75. Rob, thanks so much.
My pleasure. You have a wonderful day.
And now, here's another take on the I-75 project as we welcome Nick Schreck. He's an associate clinical professor at the Wayne State University Law School, and he directs the Transnational Environmental Law Clinic. Nick, MDOT says overhauling this 18 miles of I-75, replacing bridges, widening it, adding that high-occupancy vehicle lane, all of that is needed to bring the freeway into the 21st century. What are your thoughts?
Well, I do think that there are some design issues and safety issues that need to be addressed. The highway has been in its current form for many decades, and so it does need to be modernized. The issue that I and other people have raised with this highway is the expansion, adding lanes of traffic in either direction. And there's a real question of whether or not that additional road capacity is needed.
Now, MDOT seems to be pointing toward that extra fourth lane as being reserved for occupants of, high occupancy vehicle lanes.
Yeah, and that is an encouraging step forward. This isn't something that we've had in Michigan. And so the idea, we see these in other parts of the country where maybe during rush hour or at all times, there's those high occupancy vehicle lanes where you have to have more than one person in the car. And that's good. It encourages carpooling, and we think that's a positive step. But again, adding these extra lanes of highways where we've had difficulty, as I'm sure the listeners know, maintaining the roads that we have. And so unless there is really a demonstrated need for those extra miles of concrete to add extra capacity to the highways, it's just something that we don't think is a wise investment.
And so if you could design a project that, in your view, would make I-75 safer and also lower those rising maintenance costs that the state points to, what would that look like?
Keeping with the current footprint of the highway without adding the extra lanes, that would be the preferred scenario, although we're not going to be there. So I think, this project along I-75, it's happening. For the next 14 years, in fact, this project will be under construction in multiple phases. Really looking forward, what we're trying to do is continue to push MDOT, to push our planners to think about the smartest ways to develop these highways for the future. And oftentimes that means not investing so much in expanding highways, but in maintenance, making sure that they're up to the most modern design standards in the existing footprint, and then looking at things like transit. In a lot of areas of the country, we figured that the way to really plan for the future is not always thinking about bigger highways and longer highways. It's making sure that we have a transit plan in place where people can move on rapid bus transit or they can move on trains. And so having, that type of planning is really something that needs to be, integral to what MDOT's thinking is moving forward. So with this I-75 project, it is a good thing that we will have these high-occupancy vehicle lanes. But again, I think that good comes with the bad of adding extra highway capacity that really isn't needed.
There have been voices, for example, the group Transportation Riders United, asking why not channel some of that $1 billion being spent on all of this work on I-75 into public transportation. Then you have others like Carmine Palumbo of the Southeast Michigan Council of Government saying, hey, we shouldn't be making this either or, pitting road improvements against public transit. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it does need to be both. We need to have good public transit, and we also need to have good, reliable, safe roads and bridges and all of that. I don't think anyone would argue with that proposition. But the fact is that in Southeast Michigan, our transit funding has been woefully inadequate, and the planning has been woefully inadequate. And so, you know, one of the things we're seeing now with the Regional Transit Authority, which, by the way, there will be a ballot initiative on the ballot in November to seek funding for this Regional Transit Initiative. And that's really important because we can invest in, you know, thinking about ways to connect people from not just major urban centers, but major work centers, to get people from home to work or from school to home, and doing that in a way that is the most cost-effective from a regional perspective. We have all of these different little transit networks, but they don't necessarily think together and connect together. And so we really need to have a real investment in transit. Transit has been left behind in Southeast Michigan, and I don't think that's a surprise to anyone. We consistently rank near the very bottom for transit for metro regions of our size. So we really need to invest in transit, and I think it's time for transit to get its due, frankly. We've been building these highways over and over again in Southeast Michigan. And now it's time to make sure that we really do have an integrated approach.
Is there any thought in your mind that this project and all the slowdowns and challenges drivers, as they go through Oakland County on I-75, are going to start experiencing today, could this, in your view, have any possible impact on that November millage vote?
Well, I hope that it raises awareness. You know, lots of times people think, you know, when you get in your car, you want to get from point A to point B as quickly and safely as possible, right? That's what everybody wants. But I would hope that as people are sitting there, when there's the lane shift in effect, and they're closing down lanes, that they think about, okay, why are we doing this? What's the point? You know, is there a better way, a smarter way to move goods and move people around our region? And so I think it's an opportunity for learning and for people to think about how we make these investments and whether or not it's a smart decision. And I will say that there's some trends that are really moving towards the direction of transit. A lot of millennials, a lot of younger people like to be in walkable communities, in communities where they don't necessarily have to own a car to get from point A to point B. And so I think we're starting to see that planning creep in. But at least from my perspective, it's a little bit slow here in Michigan, and we need to really, really focus on transit and all these different modes of transportation to get people around, and not just focus on highways and on building these really, really big, massive highways, which has been sort of our main focus in Michigan over the past 50 years.
Nick Schreck is director of the Transnational Environmental Law Clinic and associate clinical professor at the law school at Wayne State University. Nick, it was great talking with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The N-word probably gets you thinking about the racial epithet used for centuries like a club against black people. Renowned painter Peter Williams has turned that version upside down and inside out. He's created an African-American superhero. His name is N-word, and he redirects the power of that charged word toward anyone who takes part in systematic acts of hate and oppression. N-word was born as Williams created a series of paintings, his response to police-related killings of black people. They'll be the centerpiece of an upcoming book to be published by Detroit's Rotland Press. Its title, The N-word. Peter Williams is here with us now. Peter, welcome.
Good to be here.
And we want to welcome the editor-in-chief and publisher of Rotland Press, Ryan Standfest, here with us. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you for having me.
Peter, you write on your website that the very most cohesive part of your decades-long journey as an artist has been work about the life of African-Americans as a subject. These paintings in N-word began, what, with Ferguson and the death of Michael Brown?
Ostensibly, I think they began with, having lived in Delaware for 12 years, I was kind of out of touch with what was going on in the larger black community. And as I began to see reports and videos of African Americans being killed by police in traffic incidences and other kinds of situations, I got more and more concerned. Finally, when Mike Brown was, I don't know how else to put it, assassinated, I was just shocked and devastated, angry, and at a loss, and felt that I needed to change the direction my work was going in.
And as I look at these paintings, they're vivid with strong blues and strong reds. And you've written that you wanted them to have a coarseness about them. You wanted them to be flat and poster-like.
I wanted them to be raw. I wanted them to make them feel like somebody just immediately recorded, like in a a jury room an image of a plaintiff. I felt that the work didn't need to be refined and prettified for the general public. I wanted to immediately touch them through the use of color, through the use of figurative works, pieces in the making of the paintings themselves. I'm a bit of a storyteller, so that was also inhabiting the way I proceeded in making the work.
And in these paintings, you introduce us to the superhero, to N-Word. Describe him to us.
The N-Word is an iconoclastic kind of fellow. I kind of relate him to the black exploitation films of the 70s. Usually the hero of some of those films was a lowlife or a pimp or somebody who wasn't quite so respected. But in the end, he came through for his community. And that's sort of the way I see the N-Word. He's a badass cat, and he's out there trying to deal with and engage in the practicalities of being an African-American. But he puts on this red and yellow outfit, and he wears a cape, which is the American flag. And so he's always out there looking at situations that blacks may find themselves in. There's one painting in which I did a piece of him diving into a crowd of policemen who are attacking black people, and I call it nightclubbing in New York. And so it's dealing with also the kind of, I guess, insights that come from the idea that there's always a duality going on in meaning. We can see the idea of nightclubbing could be a dance. It could be at a kind of amusement. But also at the same time, it really hits you, and it hits you pretty hard.
Ryan, what struck you about these paintings of Peters when you began to see them and make you think, hey, there's something we can do with this?
Well, it's the visceral quality of the paintings and the amount of humor in them. You know, the press that I founded, Rotland Press, really traffics in publications of satire, dark humor, absurd humor. But it's humor that's at the service of something. There's a strength behind it, and it tries to cut through a lot of hypocrisy. So I saw that in Peter's paintings. I saw that there was a way of dealing with form, dealing with color, referencing comic books. And that's an area that I'm very interested in with my own press, is trying to find material that sits in that realm of popular culture, but at the same time, it has a kind of strength to it. It has that acidic humor. It has that sensibility that something needs to be said. There's a sense of agency to this kind of humor. And I felt that that flowed through Peter's work. There's a satirical element to it. And I know in speaking with Peter in the past, when I knew him at Wayne State University, he was very interested in the painter Goya. Certainly a lot of Goya's work had a great deal of social content and a need to reveal something unseen. And I felt that Peter was doing that. He's saying, look at this. I want you to see this. And he was doing that with a great deal of strength.
And I know you've been crowdfunding to get this book published. You've reached the goal, so you're working on that. Mm-hmm. As this has come together, how do you plan to publish a book? What will be in it to really set these paintings up for everyone to see and experience?
Sure. Well, the idea of the book is that there's a presentation that's created to explain the paintings a little bit, give the work some sort of context. So I've written an introduction that does that. It links the paintings to, as Peter said, the blaxploitation cinema of the 70s, but also its place in the art continuum, bringing up Goya, bringing up Philip Guston, a painter who actually Peter alludes to in one of his pieces. But I also wanted a voice outside of my own. You know, one of my impulses in publishing this book is that for me, growing up in the white suburbs of Detroit as a witness to what I felt was systemic racism, I wanted to have a book in which certain issues could be addressed, but not through my own voice, not through my voice as a witness, but through others who may have more agency. So I reached out with the help of Peter and Paul Catula, his gallery, to Bill Harris, the writer Bill Harris, novelist and poet. Mm-hmm. And he provided a nice counterpoint where he had a conversation, very intimate conversation with Peter about race. In my mind, I envisioned that that would be a kind of strand that would run throughout the book alongside the paintings. It wouldn't reference the paintings, but it would give some sort of context by discussing Peter's background and his interests, as well as Bill's. And then I also decided to include a work, a short story by Lynn Crawford, Detroit writer Lynn Crawford, which indirectly references the paintings. She looked at the work and decided to create a story based upon her viewing of that work. And that story has a lot to do with being a witness. The idea of how do you put action into play to affect change versus standing at a distance and watching something.
And indeed, Peter Williams, you gave an interview that is actually excerpted in the N-word, and you say it's important to do that in the time in which you live. And you say, I always felt that term to bear witness was an inherently black kind of statement coming out of the 50s and 60s, the political struggle. How do you see these paintings and this book, The N-Word, as bearing witness?
Well, in part, I see that having been a kid who went to church, and there was the civil rights struggle in the 60s, and there was a lot of talk about bearing witness and sending church people down to the South to march in protests and things of that sort. So to me, it really sort of allows me to manufacture this idea or concept that I'm really an historian in some ways. I'm making images that hopefully will help to relate the context of what was going on by servicing some of the imagery that has been provoked by these disturbing incidences. So I'm witnessing the time, and I've always felt compelled to record the environment that I grew up in and the time that I grew up in, partly because of my travels. I started to pay more attention to history paintings, paintings that had a certain narrative that talked about what it was like 100 years ago, 200 years ago, et cetera, et cetera. And that had a profound impact on me because I could look at an artist like Bruegel and see what people wore and what their backyards looked like or their towns and things of that sort. And so in my paintings, I try to provoke the viewer into thinking, who are these people? What are their lives like? Are these truthful or untruthful? So that the viewer has to engage in themselves in a conversation about the truthfulness of what I'm saying.
As you've worked at getting this book together for Rotland Press, Ryan, what are you hoping this book, The N-Word, will bring to the national dialogue, the protest, the response to police-related deaths of black people?
Well, at the rate that it's being crowdfunded, I'm happy to say that I'm able to do a much larger print run than I originally envisioned. And my desire is that this book certainly reaches a wide audience, as wide of an audience as possible. And in so doing, to access Peter's paintings, to access his imagery that, again, confronts an issue using a particular voice, a voice that's steeped in humor, but also a voice that has a certain amount of aggression. There's an aggression in the paintings that I like. I'm very attracted to that. It's visceral, and I think we need more of that. And I think the paintings, due to the avenging hero within, really does provoke a conversation. What does it mean to be a witness? What does it mean to filter what it is that you're seeing? And in so doing, when you're invited to that conversation, then you start to think about what your own role is in
all
this.
Of us.
Yes, all of
us. Peter, do you think that we will ever see a day when that word, the N-word, is just a relic of a long-forgotten past?
No. You know, it's too evocative of what our history is about and the history of slavery throughout the globe. I think the unfortunate reality is that we're in a millennial change right now. A lot of the third world and a lot of world people are crossing barriers and renegotiating what the population is of various countries, including our own. I think the idea of getting rid of the N-word is something that's contextualized by the fact that whites perceive it as a this and African Americans perceive it as that, and never do the two ever coincide. Young people today, I feel like there's a certain awareness that race shouldn't matter. But I think on a practical level, we have to be aware that there's also a class issue. And that issue really revolves around power and money.
Well, Ryan, how can people find out more about the N-word, particularly as you get this together and plan to publish it later this year?
Sure. Well, there is currently an Indiegogo crowdfunding campaign going on. We have reached our initial goal, but we're hoping to continue raising that through August the 17th. And you'll find all about the book on the Indiegogo site. It includes images. And if you pre-purchase the book, you're helping to get it printed. In addition, there's a special limited silkscreen edition that we've created specifically to accompany this book when you help fund it. So until August 17th, there's an opportunity to continue funding it and helping it to grow and reach a larger audience.
Well, we will watch for that, and you're hoping to have this out and available by the end of this year.
September, I'm aiming at, certainly, yes.
Fingers will be crossed. Peter Williams, his paintings bearing witness to the police-related deaths of black people, will soon be published by Rotland Press in a book titled The N-Word. We've been talking with Peter and also Ryan Stanfest, who's publisher and editor-in-chief of Rotland Press. Thanks so very much to both of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
We turn now to Michigan Bookmark, our newest series where notable Michigan writers review the works of other Michigan writers. Wolf's Mouth is the title of John Smolin's new novel, a book serving up history, suspense, crime, and, yes, a love story. Author Michael Zadorian has this review.
In John Smolin's riveting new novel, Wolf's Mouth, the action begins in 1944 in Camp Autrain, a lumber camp near Munising, Michigan. But it's not a typical lumber camp. It's a prisoner of war camp, one of the many in Michigan during World War II. The prisoners are mostly German with a smattering of other nationalities. But even in an American-run POW camp, the Nazis secretly hold the reins, meting out a cruel justice to anyone who disobeys Commandant Vogel, a man known for vengeance and violence. Yet one Italian soldier, Francesco Verde, dares to defy Vogel. It's a choice that will have repercussions for the rest of his life. He also happens to be the narrator of Wolf's Mouth. In one scene at the POW camp, Francesco happens upon a terrifying and transformative sight, a wolf ripping apart a wild hare. He watches, rapt, as the wolf, its snout bloodied, fur hanging from its maw, stares up at him. In Francesco's words, "There are moments in life when you look into the eyes of another living being, and in that moment you not only see their eyes, but you are looking right into them. You are not yourself, and yet you are, and you feel utterly exposed. Everything is revealed. The truth about you, about what you are and what you aren't, it's all there to be witnessed by the eyes that are locked upon yours." That idea of self, the truth about what we are and what we aren't, arises repeatedly in Wolf's Mouth. Certainly for Francesco, especially after his sentence to death by Commandant Vogel in a secret tribunal. His crimes? Not putting enough Germans on the camp soccer team, and saving the life of an American baby who might someday grow up to fight the Nazis. Despite the absurdity of his crimes, Francesco has no choice but to escape. So he takes it on the lam to the Lower Peninsula with the help of a young Italian woman, Chiara Frangiapani. They make it to Detroit, where they transform themselves into Frank and Claire Green, a typical hard-working American couple who just happened to be fugitives. But Frank Francesco's secret self is still waiting to be discovered. A decade after the war, just when Frank thinks he's escaped his past, it catches up with him. He's contacted by a government agent who is less interested in Frank's offenses than he is in using him as bait to catch an elusive war criminal. You guessed it, Commandant Vogel, who is still plotting to execute Frank for his crimes against the Third Reich. Wolf's Mouth posits the question, is it even possible to know your true self, especially when circumstances force you to change your life, your name, your place on the earth? It also asks what it means to be true to your beliefs, even if, in the case of the Nazi characters, your beliefs are horrific. The answer is, in Frank's words, "I came to realize that the only way to survive was to lose who I was entirely. But survival isn't enough. You don't have one life, but many lives to live. With luck, you live them all. Just when you think the story is over, Smolin skillfully lets it play out even more. The final movements of the book feel like a scene in a film where the director just keeps shooting and you feel uneasy until you realize that these extended moments are where the real story is being told. Wolf's Mouth is more than just a great read. It's a historical saga about a lesser-known part of Michigan history. It's also a war story, a fugitive tale, a romance, and a courtroom drama. But more than anything, it's the story of one man's life, and all the lives that make up that life.
Michael Zadorian is the author of two novels and a collection of short fiction. His most recent novel, The Leisure Seeker, is being made into a major motion picture starring Helen Mirren, and his review of John Smolin's Wolf Mouth can be found at michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Collaborative, heart of the community, the next idea. When we really see each other, we want to help each other.
In an era when it seems much of the country is in a face-off over race, from Black Lives Matter versus All Lives Matter, you're left wondering, how do we talk about race, even change attitudes about race? Our latest contributor to The Next Idea is trying a new idea in Downriver, Wayne County, a new race canvas effort, white people talking to white people about race. Rebecca Gray is with Michigan United. They're using this new canvassing strategy to get white voters to think about race and racism. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Well, this is really good old-fashioned door-to-door canvassing, isn't it? But you're using a really interesting strategy of white voters to talk to other white voters about race. Where'd you get this idea?
So this is part of a project that has been devised by the national group People's Action, of which Michigan United is an affiliate, in order to develop a decades-long strategy to move white people on the issue of race.
And why is it important having someone knocking at the door who is white to talk to other white voters?
We made that decision based on the assumption that white voters will be more candid with other white people.
What's the goal? What's the arc of the conversation that you hope that your volunteers will have as they knock on doors downriver?
Sort of two answers to that. The project itself, the goal is to develop an idea of what are the most effective ways to talk with white people about race. The individual conversations that we're having, we are putting forth as the goal the ability of us as the white canvassers to take a minute to share our stories of when we first started to see structural racism as something that impacted our friends and loved ones.
In trying to open eyes to structural racism, what are we trying to get past?
So white people receive a lot of coded messages about race. And the structures that perpetuate racism are generally hidden from white people. So we're working to open up a space so that we can reflect on that and think about how those institutions that we have are still affecting people on the basis of race and begin to see more of that.
So let's say I'm a Downriver homeowner. I hear a knock at my door. I go to my door. What is the first question I might be asked?
So we start every conversation with the question, how do you feel in conversations when race comes up?
Which you hope would lead to what?
So we want people to have a chance to express themselves. We found that there's a real willingness and eagerness to talk, that white people don't have enough space to talk candidly about how we are affected by race, how we see race affecting the world. And so we want people to feel comfortable sharing their perspective.
What about that choice of Downriver? Why Downriver?
So as I mentioned, white people receive a lot of coded messages. And in particular, those messages are aimed at working class white folks. And downriver is a large population of working class white people. And so we want to connect with that demographic.
And I understand your canvassers are going to use something called an anti-script. What does that mean?
So if anyone has done canvassing, they've probably used a script which tells you exactly what to say, when to say it, and you're not supposed to deviate from the script. This does not connect to people on a deep level. So we've developed an anti-script that starts with this sort of open-ended question. Mm-hmm. We ask various follow-up questions to get deeper into people's experiences and often have really wonderful, personal, reflective conversations, stories that people may not have told in years. And then we also have a chance to tell our story. And then we wrap up with a survey.
Now, have you done this yourself, Rebecca? Have you gone out door to door?
Oh, yeah. I go out every time.
All right. Give me an idea of something that was really a surprise, that really, a knock on the door that really led you to an aha moment.
So the most interesting thing that I have found so far is that there is sort of a universal sentiment among white people that our systems are failing children of color, in particular with the proximity to Detroit black children. And there is at the same time a view that black adults are failing our system. And so when I hear that, I hear this real disconnect based around this idea that somehow magically at 18, people will become entirely different people than they were when they were children. And I think that a lot of the follow-up questions that I ask are around reflecting on this idea because it's not consistent with the way human developmental psychology works. Really, the fact that people can see that our systems are failing our children of color, I'm working often to have people reflect on what that means for those adults as well.
And what kind of life path it might set those children on. Now, will you be continuing this canvassing after the election? I'm just interested if this might be an ongoing – clearly this issue is going nowhere after Election Day. Might this be something that Michigan United would want to continue?
So this will be something that we continue for decades. And we will assess, based on what we found during this project, how we will move forward.
And ultimately, what are you hoping, all of you at Michigan United, hoping will come from this project, from this canvassing project?
We are working towards growing that base of volunteers who are excited to have these conversations and to develop real recommendations for people around the country who are experimenting with this work right now about how to structure conversations effectively.
And then the ultimate payoff being?
The ability to build a larger movement that is multiracial across the state of Michigan to transform our economic and political system so that it works for all of us.
Tear down some walls.
Exactly.
You can learn more about the many activities of Michigan United by going to miunited.org. Rebecca Gray is with Michigan United. Thank you so much for being with us, Rebecca.
Thank you, Cindy.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Let's turn now to Minding Michigan, our ongoing series where we explore mental health issues in our state. When you think of psychotherapy, the standard issue that probably comes to mind is a patient talking with his or her therapist. Maybe some role-playing, but lots of talking. A psychotherapist from Grand Rapids has what he believes is a better idea, mixing talking with virtual reality. Thomas Overly is using multisensory virtual reality technology to help his patients truly confront fears and anxiety triggers. He's the owner of VR Therapy and Counseling Center in Grand Rapids. Thomas, welcome to Stateside.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And we want to welcome Tammy Grifford. Tammy is one of the patients who turned to VR therapy. Hello there, Tammy.
Hello there.
Good to have you with us. Tom, tell us exactly what is virtual reality therapy.
It's basically any environment I need a person to be exposed to administer more traditional exposure therapy. In the past, we would have to rely on homework. I would have to say, okay, this week I want you to spend this much time in the setting that you're uncomfortable with, that's bringing about the anxiety. Or the other alternative was to do visualizations in session and have them imagine the stimuli and gradually expose them to it internally. Well, with VR, we get to bypass that and get directly to the source of anxiety. And so any environment I need to make, we can create, and then I expose people gradually to that in the office environment. So whatever is bringing about the anxiety, we generate it, customize it to the client, and then gradually expose them to that stimuli over time.
And what kinds of mental health issues have you found respond to virtual reality therapy?
Well, it's evidence-based for anxiety spectrum disorders. So I've treated a lot of PTSD, a lot of specific phobias, from fear of heights, fear of flying. Tammy's case in particular was a case of severe trauma that we had been working with, and her trauma ran the gamut for her. It was childhood all the way up through adulthood. And so that's why I had her here today, because we really pulled out all the stops for her treatment process.
So Tammy, what brought you to Tom and to virtual reality therapy?
To get help with all my issues. Yeah, I had a hard life. I was abused when I was little, and my mom left me when I was a baby. Just through my whole life.
So by going through virtual reality therapy, what did that do for you, Tammy, that talking about it through the years to other therapists didn't really do?
They really, really didn't. They didn't really take the time to focus on my needs and all that. So I found Thomas Ovely on his website, and he's really helped me.
Can you explain, when you come in and you're having a virtual reality session, Tammy, what happens?
My anxiety kicks in. I get panic attacks.
What is that virtual reality technology like? Do you have headphones on, or are you goggles? Are you seeing and hearing things?
Yeah, I have goggles and a headphone, and then he has a program that he makes for me. Tom, he talks to me and helps me through the program that I'm on.
In Tammy's case, with the variety of abuse that she suffered through as a child, she had been carrying that around most of her life. And with her case, it's quite common with PTSD for victims to have traumatic nightmares. And when they're having nightmares their entire life about some of the experiences that they've had, they can change form. So in Tammy's case, not only was I dealing with the traumatic memories, but she had laid in some of her own elements from her nightmares onto the original trauma. And the way PTSD sustains itself is whenever the brain re-experiences the traumatic memory, the same chemical cocktail is found in the brain, and that's what sustains the PTSD. That's why PTSD can go on for a lifetime with some people. And so in Tammy's case, she had described these nightmares that she was having frequently. And so I took elements from those nightmares, put them in a simulation, and she was able to experience them. And the very first time she went in, I watched as Tammy's entire body became flush just from being within a certain proximity of the elements of the program. And so over time, we spent multiple sessions in there, and she was able to reduce that reaction. And as I was doing that, I would get reports from Tammy, and she would say, okay, I've had only two nightmares this week. And that, so I followed that progress until we got to the point where she was no longer having the nightmares.
And so it strikes me, if, for example, if you were dealing with somebody who had PTSD from a battlefield situation or someone
right.
who had fear of flying, you could recreate all of those specific tailor-made issues for your patient through virtual reality.
Right. And I've done that. I've worked with Marines. I've put them on bases and had mortars going off so they could habituate to the sound of explosions so that they could experience the 4th of July without having that kind of anxious reaction to those sounds.
Now, what about the cost of this therapy, Tom? How does it compare with traditional therapy?
We are actually Medicaid, Medicare providers. We accept most commercial insurance plans. So usually it's no more expensive than any other form of therapy.
And I know you recently won a $30,000 prize in Comcast Innovation for Entrepreneurs contest. What do you want to use that award money to do?
Well, everything we've talked up to this point was what we did last year, and that was to treat anxiety spectrum disorders. This year, we're moving into the behavioral realm, and that's what we won the contest for. It was for the system. It's called a behavioral rehearsal system. And what that does, it allows me to actually enter into virtual reality with my clients. And in the essay I wrote for that contest, I gave as an example, if we have, for instance, a teenage girl who is having difficulties in the school setting with other peers, with teachers, now what we can do is we put them in that school in virtual reality, populate it with other teenagers and teachers that match the types of teenagers she's around. And then I get to go in, and the system uses full body and facial motion tracking. So what happens is it translates all of my real-time movement into any character within the environment that I need to control. So I could hop in, for instance, into the body of another teenage girl and present the kind of scenario that they've been having difficulty with so that they're able to use new communication skills and learn new communication skills to better address the problems they're experiencing at school.
Now, have you had any patients respond negatively to this kind of therapy?
No, actually, the only problem I've faced, which is faced in most therapy, is with early dropout. I've had people drop out before we even get to the virtual reality portion of the treatment. But as far as people who have completed it, that was what inspired me to really do this. In the original research, I found that across studies, people tend to stick with this kind of therapy through to the end. And so there's less of a dropout rate. And that's what my experience has been since we opened up last year.
Now, to your knowledge, are you the first in Michigan marrying virtual reality technology with psychotherapy?
In Michigan, definitely. And as far as I know, in this general region, most of the people I did my research on were people on the East Coast, military related, and then West Coast, more university related.
And what would it take to get this technology into the hands of other therapists and the training to use it?
Well, that's our next goal for the business, and that's what we are going to be using that money for from the Comcast contest. I want to bundle this system, make it relatively inexpensive. We'd like to be able to train other therapists to use it and have the best tools at their disposal to administer therapy.
How long does a run of therapy usually take, a course of therapy, Tom?
The average treatment time for VR therapy is about 3 months. And, of course, that just depends on the nature of the trauma and the individual themselves. But average treatment time is about 3 months, with about two of that consisting of the VR treatment. We start out by teaching basic breathing and relaxation techniques before we even get to the virtual reality portion of things.
Taking psychotherapy and mixing it with multisensory virtual reality. Thomas Overly, psychotherapist and owner of VR Therapy and Counseling Center in Grand Rapids, and one of his clients, Tammy Grifford. We want to thank both of you very, very much for sharing the virtual reality treatment for mental health patients. Very fascinating stuff. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you miss any part of today's show, it's very, very easy to find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcasts to find the link. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our engineer is Bob Scon. Contributors include Josh Hakala, Daniel Razel, Carl Williams, and Tony Brown. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.